What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is your host, Ramsey Bolton, and welcome to the Flayed Man. Guys, welcome to the Flayed Man podcast. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about today. Today we're going to discuss Season 4, Episode 4 of Game of Thrones, titled Oathkeeper. This episode was directed by Michelle McLaren of Breaking Bad fame, and is written by Brian Cogman. I was kind of disappointed, Michelle McLaren, because in Season 3, she directed one of the worst episodes, Season 3, Episode 7, The Barren Maiden Fear. That was such an atrociously directed episode that it almost single-handedly ruined the Game of Thrones season. So I was a bit worried, but she did a pretty good job this episode, so that's all good. And a writer, Brian Cogman, this is the first episode of the season that wasn't written by the Double Ds, by the Double D Penetration, Benioff and Weiss. Brian Cogman, I'm good friends with him on Twitter. And this is also a really well-written episode, so Brian Cogman usually delivers, that's not an issue. So this episode starts off with a little Sisterhood 2 action, if you get what I mean. Give me some of that chicken, baby. So we see, Grey Worm and Missandei. And we see that Missandei is teaching Grey Worm how to read. And this actually doesn't happen in the books, but I guess the show is trying to build up some backstory to try and give these characters some more life and not just make them display them as slaves, which the show has been getting criticized of late. And we see that Grey Worm says pretty strongly, "Kill the masters, kill the masters, kill the masters." Anywho, it's ironic that right when he says kill the masters, Dany walks in. Because so far, Dany has been the one who's freeing all the cities, right? So, is that just a weird cut? Because that seemed like a pretty awkward cut between Grey Worm saying kill the masters and Dany walking in. So one wonders whether that will have any added significance later on. I don't know, but that's just some insight you probably won't get on A Cast of Kings, probably. Anywho. So, Grey Worm and Missandei obviously are developing some relationship. It's unclear whether it's a family relationship or something more deeper. But we'll see where that goes. So the next scene goes to the slaves in Meereen, and we see the slaves are holding one giant-ass slave session where they're talking about Dany's proposal that the slaves rise up and take their freedom. And a couple things about the scene. One, how are the slaves able to meet? Like, I know this is a secret meeting, but one wonders, like, after Dany shows up at Meereen and tells all the slave masters who are standing on the wall that she wants to free all the slaves, that the slaves should all rise up and revolt, you would think that the slave masters, the masters, would have enacted a rule saying, especially then when Danny shows up, that the slaves can't hold meetings by themselves. I know the slaves are many times the number of the masters. I think it's like 3-1. But still, the masters are the one who control all the weaponry, all that stuff. So that's just a little silly that these hundreds of slaves could have a secret meeting. But whatevs. The show is too awesome, so who cares? So anywho, Grey Worm shows up to this meeting, and he brings a lot of weapons. So Grey Worm dons a slave clothing. I don't know where he got the slave clothing. He probably found it somewhere. But it shows up, he dons some slave clothing, and he brings all these weapons to these slaves, the Marini slaves, and he gives them. And the slaves are like, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. And because now they have the weaponry to rise up, and Grey Worm gives a pretty inspiring speech saying, no one gives you your freedom, you need to take it. So next scene, we see a master walking, and with a couple of guards. This is the same master from last week that we saw. And on the wall, written in English, presumably in blood, are the words, kill the masters. First thing is, in Marine, why would the Marinese be writing in the common tongue English? Because everyone talks in Valyrian, I thought. Unless, this was, a lot of people are confused about this, but I guess a couple of reasons that can make this up are that Grey Worm instructed the slaves to write it in English as a way to show like the foreign influence of Danny creeping in. I don't know, that's just so... is that a continuity error? Or is that something the show intended? Other podcasts are saying it's a continuity error. You can guess which podcast I'm talking about. But with a little deeper analysis, we can see this could be an indication of Danny's foreignness creeping into Marine. So we see the master... He sees that, then he turns around. He sees Kill the Master, he turns around. His bodyguards point to the top of the ziggurat pyramid. I don't know what you call that. I guess it's one of their religious pyramids. These guys, the Marinese, they worship the harpy. And on top of the pyramid, on the top of the harpy, is a flag covering the harpy. And the flag is the Targaryen flag. Fire, blood, vengeance. I think this is the first time we have actually seen the Targaryen flag. And this is a flag from the ships. A lot of people are wondering, where did Danny's forces get this flag from? They got it from the ships. A lot of people have emailed in questions, and I'll talk to them in the next segment after the break. A lot of podcasts have confused you guys, so I just want to answer all your questions. That's primarily what this is going to be about, answering all your questions that you might have had regarding this episode. So we see that Mastrake is brutally killed by the Myrni slaves who are rising up and revolting. And this entire sequence happens really quickly. Literally, like, he's the only master that we see get murdered. And I wonder, like, couldn't they have shown us, at least, like, panned out and shown, like, pandemonium all through the streets of Meereen with the slaves rising up, revolting, killing the masters? Because in the books, George doesn't do it, but he discusses it between chapters. Like, at the end of the first chapter, he initiates a slave revolt, and at the beginning of the next chapter, he shows the aftermath of it, which is pretty brutal. The slaves are pretty brutal towards their masters. And for some reason, the show didn't do that. They showed one master getting killed, and the next shot were the freed slaves lining up the streets. One reason that the show might have skipped all that, because a lot of people were confused about, like, why wouldn't this show us all these masters getting killed? Why would they only show us one master? Maybe to show the expediency of Danny's conquest? Maybe to hint at a certain modern war? Wink, wink. Nudge, nudge. Another podcast. I didn't hear that on Cast of Kings, Joanna. God. Anywho. So next scene, our slaves lining up the street screaming, "My son, my son, my son, my son, my son!" If I hear "my son" one more goddamn time, I swear to God. So this is probably exact same thing, repetition of Ask Porn Yunkai. The slaves are all like, oh, thank you, Danny. Thank you, Jorah. Is there any way I can satisfy you, Jorah? Never mind, but... And we see the masters. The masters are all dressed up in colorful clothing. And one of the interesting things about this show regarding Meereen is the masters are... So we see that there are a lot of white masters here, as well as a lot of African masters. And that's another thing that's interesting, because in the previous episode, a lot of the masters that we saw were African. And this is good historical context, because Americans, majority of people think that it's pretty like white, it's a white-black thing. And that's true for America, but in Africa, there was slavery happening too. And the masters were African, and slaves were Africans from other tribes. And that's sort of what's happening in Meereen. Meereen is an Essos. Essos represents like the Africa, Middle East portion. We see that a lot of slave masters are also African. So it's a good thing they're not HBO and the double D penetration aren't just going with a stereotypical white-black relationship. And they're showing the black-on-black master-on-slave relationship, because that's a really interesting thing that makes Meereen separate from like previous slave master stories. So we see Danny watching all these masters, and she is wondering, she's asking Barristan, how many slaves' children were pinned up on the wall to Meereen? Barristan's like, 163, Your Grace. And Danny says, okay, let's nail up these motherfuckers. And Barristan has a look on his face and says, sometimes it's better to answer injustice with mercy. I will answer injustice with justice. And we see Barristan has a look on his face. Is he reminiscing to the days of the Mad King when he saw so much destruction happening, so many killings? Is he seeing a little crazy in Danny's eyes? Because no one thinks Danny's crazy. Everyone thinks Danny's a messiah. And it's debatable if you can agree or disagree with Danny. There's really no valid side here. She wants revenge for the brutality of what the masters did. So she does the exact same thing with 163 masters. It's pretty gruesome. She nails them hard. Joanna, hard against the crosses. And yeah. So one wonders what's going to happen with Danny's storyline. Because the next, we see Danny standing on the wall overlooking Meereen. And she has a look of triumphancy on her face. And you could almost see the mission accomplished line behind her. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You see what maybe the show is trying to get to. Because a lot of other podcasts that I've listened to just didn't understand why would this show just go through so quickly through the Meereen conquest. Maybe as a comparison to a modern day war that we thought we had won, but in fact we didn't win. I sort of hope they don't do that political comparison thing, because there's so much of that in Hollywood already that it'll be just really boring. They need to add spiciness to the storyline, not another boring storyline. But we'll see where this goes. But that's probably one reason why Danny's conquest happened so quickly. So the next scene is between Jaime and Bronn. Bronn, the common sellsword. And we see them practicing where Bronn is busy sleeping with Lord Leywood's wife. Bronn. I bet Bronn's better than Pod, right? Oh yeah, Joanna knows all about that. Okay, never mind, but... So we see Bronn and Jaime fighting. Jaime's getting better, becoming a better fighter. He's actually giving Bronn a much harder time than last week. We see that Jaime's developing his skills with his left hand. Except Bronn still fights dirty. And that's why Jaime still hasn't learned how to fight dirty. Bronn grabs Jaime's golden hand and whacks him across the face with it. Whacks him! Whacks him! Jaime's like, what the fuck, dude? And Bronn's like, YOLO, bitches. Anywho. So Bronn and Jaime reminisce. Bronn basically asks Jaime, do you think Tyrion murdered the king? Bronn's like, no. And then Bronn gives a story about the Eerie, in which Tyrion said that he would wait for Jaime to come and save him. Even though Bronn stood up as Tyrion's champion, Tyrion wanted Jaime to be his champion. So Jaime feels a link with his brother again, and he feels slightly, you can see the look of guilt on his face that he hasn't visited Tyrion yet. So in the next scene is between Tyrion and Jaime. Jaime's visiting Tyrion. They have a little playful banter here, in which Tyrion quizzes Jaime, you know, Joffrey was your son, right? Jaime's like, dude, seriously gonna bring that up right now? That's something Dave Chensky would do. So Jaime basically tells Tyrion that there's really nothing he can do to help him. Like, Tyrion's locked up in this cell. There's really nothing he can do to help him. So Tyrion's like, alright, dude. I'm just gonna chill here then, I guess. Jaime gives a little update about Cersei, that what Cersei wants him to kill Tyrion. Tyrion's like, yeah, that's what I expected from that crazy biatch. And we move on to Littlefinger and Sansa. This is a great scene. I love Littlefinger. A lot of people can't stand Aiden Gillen's acting for some reason. I don't know why. They can't stand his accent or something. I think his accent's perfect. He captures the manipulative Machiavellian sense of Littlefinger. And just the way he uses his facial expressions in the scene, his deliverance of lines, I think he's one of the best actors. I don't understand. Like, I understand people who like don't understand what being a good actor is, like Jonah Robinson can't stop from criticizing him, but he's a great actor. We saw him from The Wire. When we see him here, I think he's a great actor. And people like Alan Sepinwall agree, so take that, cast of Kings. Take it. Take it. So basically, Littlefinger's explaining to Sansa, step by step, what happened. And Sansa, you can see, is developing a little bit of a more acute sense. She's becoming smarter. She's guessing. She doesn't trust Littlefinger. She's not the stupid little girl we saw in the first season. And Littlefinger, you can see, what does Littlefinger want? That's why he's such a good actor, because you can't see what he wants. Does he want everything? Like, power? Does he want, like, not to sit on Iron Throne, to not sit on the Iron Throne? What does he want out of Sansa? Does he want to see Sansa become great because he loved Catelyn? One wonders all those things. And Littlefinger basically says that he helped the Tyrells. And that moves on to the next scene, where we see Olenna basically telling Margaery that she would never have let her little Rose marry that crazy little boy, King Joffrey. And you can see the look of shock on Margaery's face, because other podcasts have mentioned, like, why would Margaery be so surprised? Like, why couldn't she have guessed that Olenna would have killed Joffrey? And those podcasts just don't understand Margaery. Margaery's not, like, an evil killer. She wants power. She wants to become the queen. But she's not a killer. That's the difference. Like, she couldn't contemplate killing the king at his own wedding. She doesn't have that ruthlessness that her grandmother has. So you can see the look of shock in Marjorie's face. And we'll see where that relationship goes. We also see that the Queen of Thorns is leaving. Now that she basically accomplished what she wanted to do. So Marjorie, it's unclear whether she's the queen. She's probably betrothed to Prince Tommen now. Tommen's underage, so Cersei is still queen regent. And Queen of Thorns basically tells Margaery that she needs to start getting her grips around Tommen. She starts clawing, riding Tommen, riding him hard. Because Cersei is going to start manipulating the boy against Margaery. So basically, Margaery needs to get there first. She can't allow Cersei to manipulate him against her. So Margaery, being the person she is, we'll see if she takes that advice into practice. So next we go up to the wall. We see her favorite Night's Watch boys, Gren, Pip, Jon Snow, Dorset, all those boys. And because they really developed bonds in season 1, it's been nice to see them develop. And we see Jon basically helping the Night's Watch learn how to fight against the wildlings. Jon knows the wildlings to fight using two hands, two swords, two weapons. So he's teaching the wildlings this. And we see a certain scruffy fur person in the new recruits. Who is that? It's our favorite guy, Locke. Vargo Lockhart. Vargo Lockhart. Hoket. Book readers know what I'm talking about. Oh yeah. So we see Locke introduce himself to Jon Snow, and Locke fights another Night's Watch recruit. He beats the living shit out of this recruit because Locke, as we know, is a professional fighter. And next we see Alistair Thorne come in, and basically he reminds Jon Snow of his place and tells Jon Snow that you're a steward. I know you've been over the north of the wall. I know you've been with Rose Leslie, Ygritte Snowsbane, the Fury Redhead, getting it on, teaching her the Lord's Kiss. Joanna wants to know what that means. Oh man, that podcast is so clueless. I just feel so bad for them. Anywho. So Jon, you can see the tension. There's always been tension between Jon and Alistair since season one. But Jon basically gives his stare down to Alistair and goes back to being steward. So the next scene is a really interesting scene between Cersei and Jaime. We all know what happened last week. I don't want to keep on bitching about that. And we see, I guess, it's unclear whether what Cersei, because Cersei is such a fucked up person. That's what one thing like other podcasts aren't talking about is, like, we're all basing Cersei's reaction based on what like normal women would react based on what happened to her. But this relationship is so fucked up that you can't hold those normal standards to like how they're supposed to interact. Like if Jaime did that to Cersei last episode, then everyone in like a cast of kings, like everyone like Joanna was like, wait, why isn't Cersei acting like this? Why? I'm a mean girl. That's totally, like, not fetch. Why? Because this is such a fucked up relationship. Everything about this is messed up. So why are we holding them to normal standards of how they should act based on what happened to them? That's the thing, like, we have no idea how they're supposed to act. We don't know what's going inside their heads. Because we've never lived anything close to being inside their heads. So, I agree, like, what happened last week was definitely, like, totally, like, not fetch. But we shouldn't analyze so much when we have no idea how fucked up this relationship is. So that's some insight onto that. And we see Cersei basically telling Jaime, she addresses him really formally, so you know there's tension there. And she basically tells Jaime, if I asked you to get Sansa's head, would you do it? And you can see Jaime's really reluctant. He sees the craziness in Cersei, but he can't really say anything because Cersei is the queen regent and his lover. And Cersei's basically blaming Tyrion, and she's immovable. Nothing can change her opinion. And you can see Jaime is really embattled in what he should do. So the next scene is we finally meet Tommen. Tommen, I actually like this actor. He's a pretty good actor. Dean Charles Chapman. We're good friends on Facebook. Yeah, you don't have that relationship, do you, Julia? Anywho, we see that Cersei mentions how there's so few Kingsguard guarding Tommen. And in the next scene, we see Margaery slip in to King Tommen's bedroom. One wonders how did Margaery slip in, because she was carrying a torchlight. She seemed to have walked into the front door. How did Kingsguard fail to notice Margaery was walking in? Did she do something? Muhahaha. Yeah, that's right, India Walford. You know what I'm talking about. So Marcia comes in, and basically she's starting to set her claws around Tommen, literally and figuratively, because we know Sir Pounce, our favorite cat, jumps up on and gives Tommen the biggest cock block. So this Tommen is basically the best night of Tommen's life, with Marjorie walking in. And we can see Marjorie telling Tommen that we should have some secrets between us. We don't need to tell Cersei everything. We should have some secrets between us. And Tommen's like, oh, anything, Marjorie. Anything. Anything, Marjorie. Anything I can do for you. So Marjorie knows she has Tommen for the kill. And next scene is between Jaime and Brienne. We see Jaime and Brienne, we know their relationship from last year. That's one of the best parts of season 3, Jaime and Brienne. So Jaime's basically sending Brienne, he gives Brienne Oathkeeper, which Brienne's really amazed that Jaime's giving it. And Brienne names it Oathkeeper. And you can see the look on Jaime's face, like, yeah, you better keep up your oaths. He gives Brienne a new set of armor, and basically sets Brienne on this quest to find Sansa, because remember, Catelyn Stark only freed Jaime in return for the Stark daughter's return. And we can see that Jaime wants to redeem himself. He saw his list in the Kingsguard book. He barely has anything compared to all the other great knights, because he was completely fucked up his life so far. So Jaime wants to start doing some good stuff, so he directly goes behind Cersei's back, and instead of bringing Sansa's head to King's Landing, he sends Brienne to go save Sansa. And who gets to go with Sansa? None other than Lord Tripod. Is he going to teach Brienne the holy wonders, the pleasures of the world? Jonah never experienced that, nor did Indy at Walford. So we see the look between Jaime and Brienne as they leave. It's pretty similar to the look that Brienne gives Jaime when Jaime's leaving Harrenhal. So one wonders whether Jaime and Brienne will ever cross paths. Probably, but who knows. So Jaime's on this path of redemption. There was just the minor thing that happened last week. Minor. But basically everything else, he's on the path of redemption. So next scene is when Jon Snow is back at Castle Black. We see Jon and Sam arguing. Sam's pissed off that he left Gilly at Molestown. And Sam being the dumbass that he is. Goddamn. Sam's just really annoying at this point. So Jon Snow basically is guessing that he knows that Bran, because Sam told him that Bran headed north of the wall. So Jon's guessing that they're resting up in abandoned villages. And one of them is Craster's Keep. And Jon knows the mutineers are there. So Jon needs volunteers, because The Baldy, former Kingsguard leader. So Alistair Thorne and Janos Slynd. Yeah, that's the name, Janos Slynd. Janos mentions to Alistair that the Lord Commander, because Lord Commander Mormont is dead, they need to elect a new Lord Commander. Jon Snow is obviously the popular guy. So Janos tells Alistair that maybe you should send Jon Snow to Craster's Keep. Who knows? Maybe he could die. Wouldn't that solve a lot of things in terms of getting who gets a Lord Commander job? So Alistair tells Jon, fine, take anyone you want to Craster's Keep, but it can only be volunteers. So Jon gives a pretty rousing speech saying, Lord, if we're all brothers of the Night's Watch, then Lord Commander Mormont was our father. Who here will avenge him? Who's your daddy now, Joanna? Who's your daddy now? So we see a bunch of Night's Watch mates rise up to help Jon. Jon acknowledges them. And next we see Locke rise up. And there's a deliberate change in the tone of the music right when Locke rises. It's so deliberate that you can pretty much tell that HBO 1 it to be deliberate. This wasn't like something silly. This was trying to be deliberate. So we see Locke is stand up. We know why Locke is here. Locke is sent by Roose Bolton to find Brandon Rickon and presumably dispose of them because they're Starks and Starks have always ruled the North. And also presumably dispose of Jon Snow because Jon's half, he's a bastard, but he's still half Stark. So he's still a threat. So Locke's going to go with Jon Snow because Locke overheard Jon Snow mentioning Bran, so who knows what's going to happen. That's something that didn't happen in the books at all, this entire Craster's Keep thing. So it's going to be something, it's going to be a huge tinderpot next week. So right after this, we go to Apocalypse Now, aka Craster's Keep. We see all the Night's Watch people, the depraved members of the Night's Watch, staying, basically engaging in all the most depraved acts of humanity. Carl Tanner drinking wine from Gior Mormont's skull. That's a pretty nice souvenir, actually. Bern Gorman is such a good actor. He gets like those really memorable parts. He played them so well. He has really good range. So we see this is a pretty uncomfortable scene to watch, but we had to establish the depravity of how many members of the Night's Watch are acting like these animals. So we see Rast here. Carl basically orders Rast to take the baby. It's Craster's last baby, and the wives are all chanting, "The one true God, the one true God, the one true God." So Carl is like, "One true God? Hail Hydra. Hail Hydra, Dave Chensky. Hail him again, again, and again. Up your little yellow ass." So Rast takes his baby outside and he places them, and we can hear the baby's squeals of terror and snow. It's pretty disturbing. Rast leaves him out for the White Walker. Next, Rast goes and taunts Ghost. A lot of people in other podcasts are asking, "Oh, how was Ghost tied up into that cage? How was Ghost tied up?" Look, if you can't think of scenarios of how Ghost would go into a cage, you're honestly too dumb to exist. So, like, all the Night's Watch people would have to do to get Ghost in a cage is, like, dump a ton of meat in the cage. When Ghost goes in, then someone rushes in and closes the door. Something like that. Like, it's not that unfeasible. Even though Ghost's one big-ass direwolf. And the show presumably reestablished Ghost. I don't think we've seen Ghost since, like, the beginning of season 3, probably. Because John will probably get Ghost when he comes to Craster's Keep. Who knows what will happen. Like I said, this never happened in the books. So this is going to be something big that happens. So finally, actually, no, not before that really infamous scene, but we see Bran. Bran goes full working into Summer to check out Hodor hears the screams of the baby, and he wakes up to a Hodor. So Bran works into Summer. Summer goes into a trap, presumably set up by these Night's Watch people for Ghost. That's another thing. They had a trap set up for the direwolf. That's how Summer got trapped. So they could have done the same thing for Ghost and just shoved him into that cage. This is all stuff that other podcasts didn't think about. But that's why, see, listening to other podcasts represents the dumbness of this country. Like, a cast of kings like 44th. But they're so, like, mentally ill, to put it kind of, to be generous. But I guess it just represents the mental capacity of the American viewing audience, that you need to listen to such a stupid podcast, and you can't handle a smarter podcast. The Chensky henchmen are rising in revolt. But who cares? I just feel so bad for them. Anyhow. So we see Bran, Jojen, and Mira. They try to go and free Summer, but they get caught by these Night's Watch at Craster's Keep. the mutineers. And next scene is a really evil scene. Hodor's chained up, he's getting shoved, and gets stabbed by Rast. And Rast says something. He says, "If I was as big as you, I'd rule the fucking world." And we see an extended shot of Hodor looking at the blood in his hands. So one wonders whether Hodor will get revenge on Rast? See, you won't get that type of insight in the Cast of Kings. But, like I said, the American viewing audience really isn't that smart, so... pity, pity, pity. So, Carl Tanner shoves Bran, Mira, Jojen. Jojen starts having a seizure. No one gives a shit, because no one gives a shit about Jojen. But presumably Jojen is having a vision about something. And Mira gets some uncomfortable glances at Hector, and Bran finally says, "Look, I'm Brandon Stark." And Carl's like, "Oh, you're Stark. Political hostages are valuable." So even though Carl's such a bastard, he understands the value of political hostages. So this is going to be one big-ass scene next week, presumably. We know Jon's forces are coming to Craster's Keep. We know literally everyone is here. I hope they don't have like Jon just miss Bran again like he did when he escaped Ygritte's group. But who knows what will happen. We know Locke's showing up. There are a lot of different moving pieces in action, so that's one of the great things about Game of Thrones. So finally, we go to that scene. The White Walker picks up the baby. This is a White Walker on the horse. The same White Walker that looked at Sam, or probably, I don't know, all White Walkers look the same. The whites look all different because they're reanimated zombies, but White Walker on the horse looked at Sam, and then this looks like the same dude. He picks up the baby, then he goes riding on the horse. I don't know how the baby is still alive by the time this White Walker rides through this minus 60 degree weather, but presumably they have some modern heating techniques. The White Walkers, they're actually 21st century intellectuals from California. So, somehow the baby's still alive. And the White Walker basically goes, and this scene is not in the books, and you probably heard by now, everyone was like, "What the fuck?" Joanna was basically having a seizure when she watched this. She's like, "Listen, it's not in the books! It's not in the books! It's not in the books!" Oh my god, is there anything more annoying than a book purist? Oh my god. So, we see the White Walker, and basically goes to Icehenge. We see 13 icicles, and we see 13 cloaked somethings. We're unclear what they were. We know they're in association with the White Walkers, but they don't look like the White Walker. The White Walker seems to be working for these people. And someone presumed that this is the Night's King. An HBO intern may have started this entire ruckus just to fuck with all the book readers. Who knows? But it could be the Night's King, because there are 13. There were 13 of those cloaked people. As we know, the Night's King was the 13th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. So, I'll address this more in the next section of this podcast, where we go over all the readers' questions. We got a ton of readers' questions because they were so confused listening to other people's podcasts. So the White Walker basically puts the baby here, and one of the 13 comes up, Darth Voldemort, let's call him that. Combination Darth Maul and Voldemort. So pale Darth Voldemort shows up, touches the baby's cheek with his long-ass fingernail. Jesus Christ, don't they cut their fingernails? I don't know what it says, that's the thing that most annoyed me. But we see the baby's eyes turning blue, and we see another White Walker is formed. So there are a ton of questions about the scene. That's definitely what the Double D Penetrations wanted us to talk about. They wanted to engender all these questions. So that's basically a summary of this. So next, we're going to talk about all the questions we received from viewers. We got a ton of questions, a lot of them criticisms of A Cast of Kings, Bald Move, Unspoiled Pocket. And we'll really dive into these emails. So hold on, and after the music, we'll enter the spoiler section. See you later. So as I said, we received a lot of feedback this week, even more than last week. And I can't go through all of it, but I'll go through the main ones that summarize a lot of people's questions. So the first feedback is from Dave Robinson. And, he's another Cast of Kings refugee. We've been receiving a lot of them. I guess people can't stand listening to a poor podcast, I guess. Anywho, he says that I listened to Joan Robinson explain Marine, but I'm still really confused as to what Marine is, what the point of it is, and why Dany is traveling to Marine instead of traveling to Westeros now that she has an army. Okay, good question, Dave. If you don't listen to informative podcast, you'll be really confused about this, and it'll seem really silly. Anyway, Marine is the largest slave city in Slaver's Bay. Slaver's Bay is the bay that contains Astapor, the first city Dany frees, where she got all her Unsullied, Yunkai, the second city Dany frees, where she got the Second Sons, and Daario, and lastly Marine, which is dubbed the mother of all slave cities. So Marine is basically the most ancient slave city. It engendered these other slave cities. It's where the majority of these slaves come from. It's the cruelest slave city. It's an ancient culture. So Dany, we see that Dany is on the quest. We know Dany has her army. We know Dany wants to claim the Iron Throne. But what's more important to her? Claiming the Iron Throne or freeing slaves and ending this evil practice in her eyes, even though it's been going on for thousands of years in Slaver's Bay? So Dany really feels it's her destiny to free these slaves, and that's why she's heading to Marine. But Marine is the last city in Slaver's Bay. There's no other cities for her to move on. I know it's a bit of a trope right now. She's going from city to city to city, but Marine's the last city. So it seems that she conquered Marine, so we'll see what she does next. I hope I answered your question, Dave. Good question. Keep on sending your questions in. I know people are really confused listening to other podcasts. So the next question is from Joanna Chensky. And she said, I listened to Cast of Kings last week, and they confused me about Peter Baelish. Baelish said that he went to the Eyrie several weeks ago, so why was he still chilling here? I was hoping you could help me answer this because you're a smarter podcast. Good question, Joanna. Basically, Peter Baelish said he was at the Eyrie. Said, wink, wink, Littlefinger voice. Littlefinger's Irish voice. Accents aren't a pit. Accents are a ladder. Anywho, Peter Baelish never was at the Eyrie. He was always chilling here, always waiting for his plan to come to fruition. And now we see that he's heading to the Eyrie. But Peter Baelish tricked everyone. That's the thing about the fog in episode 2. It kept his boat hidden. It was ominous. But there was a point to that fog, in that no one knew that Peter Baelish was actually chilling here. We all know that Peter Baelish has been called the most dangerous man in Westeros. He would burn Westeros to the ground if he could be king of the ashes. That's what Varys said, didn't he? That's all you need to know about that man. We'll see where he goes. We know he's heading to Eyrie now, to Catelyn's crazy sister. So, who knows what Baelish is up to. But chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. The next question is from Katie Rich. She's actually a Vanity Fair editor. Huh, how about that? Anyway, she said she listened to her own podcast, Acock, and she was confused about the Other King. She didn't understand like what the Other King stood for, like who was that cloaked person. So I don't think we're supposed to understand who the cloaked person was. One of the great things the D&D do is they like pissing off the book readers. They like annoying us. We saw that last week, how much controversy they created with that scene between Jaime and Cersei. And that was purely deliberate. I know a lot of people are saying it's a mistake, but that was deliberate. Because think about how much controversy, how much publicity they generated. No amount of advertising money could generate that much publicity where everyone was talking about it. So, and we saw the viewership go up. It was 6.9 million viewers for this episode. So the viewership went up. More people were talking about it, more people saw it. In this episode, another similar scene. More people were talking about this other scene because it didn't happen in the books or wasn't mentioned. And now even more controversy is generated. So that's a great thing that D&D do. It's really deliberate. I know other podcasts are like, oh, so it was a mistake by them. It was a mistake. No, it wasn't a mistake. It was a deliberate move by D&D to engender more controversy. And really smart. They're really smart guys in charge of this show. We should trust them. So we see the 13 cloaked people that the White Walker gives the baby to. And a lot of people are wondering whether this is the Night's King. The Night's King, this is just some history, this isn't a spoiler, but the Night's King was a Lord Commander, the 13th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. He was a Bolton. He was a Bolton, and he was the 13th Commander of the Night's Watch. And we see Old Nan tells the story about the Night's King to Bran in Season 1. The Night's King, he fell in love with an other, with the White Walker woman. And they presumably had love with each other, and the Night's King basically gave his soul away to the White Walkers because he was in love with this White Walker woman. So a lot of people are wondering, is this the Night's King that we've heard so much about? It might be. Who knows? But that's just another bit of controversy that the show has generated. So I expect the viewership to go up again. And lastly, I just wanted to quickly read a review. We got a lot of good references. The last one is from India Walford. And she's writing in, "Hi, I listen from Warwickshire, England. I initially listened to podcasts like Bold Move, Unspoiled Podcast, A Cast of Kings by Joanna Robinson and Dave Chensky. And those podcasts made a lot of stupid mistakes. I'm just a show watcher, but I want to understand the complexity of the show. I don't want it dumbed down for me by listening to dumb people talking about it. I want smart people talking about it. I guess that's one of the reasons why you said you work at Google and got a perfect score, whereas Dave Chensky works at Microsoft. Probably because he's a bit too daft to work at a smarter company. And judging by listening to his podcast, that's not much of a engendering thing to say. So I just wanted to thank you for your creating this podcast. A lot of my friends are listening to it. We know that the Bolton and the Chensky henchmen are trying to disparage this podcast, but trust me, a lot of people are liking it. You're talking really explosively. You're nicely critiquing other podcasts that make really stupid mistakes that make me want to go punch their keyboard. So I just want to thank you for all your work and keep up the good work. Thank you, India. That's a really nice email you sent. Yeah, thank you. You basically summarized all our thoughts. That's what the reason I created this podcast. This podcast wasn't to create a rivalry with Vanity Fair. This podcast wasn't to establish my dominance over Dave Chensky, the Chensky Master, or Divya, or Joe Blow. It was to help the viewers understand the complexity of the show while not dumbing it down and making stupid mistakes. Because there's no Game of Thrones is a once-in-a-lifetime show. There's a lot of stupid shows out there that these podcasts can address. But if you want to address a show like Game of Thrones, you need to be smart. You need to have a sharp mind. Unfortunately, some of us are blessed with sharp minds, and some of us aren't. I think we all know who we're talking about and who we're referring to. So thanks for all your emails. Keep up the good work, keep up the good reviews, and I'll be back next week. Hiya, Bolton.
running.